Hello and welcome. It's been another week of political uncertainty in France and a case of electoral dysfunction after the results of President Macron's snap election left no party with a clear majority. The far right, ultimately coming in third place, were defeated, they say, by the system, claiming it a victory deferred. So as many headlines ask, et maintenant, on fait quoi? What now?
We are in the grip of a de facto coup. The man who dissolved Parliament is not calling on anyone to form a government.
N'appelle personne pour constituer un gouvernement.
It's been a week that's seen Ukraine's NATO membership assured and described as irreversible, according to leaders who met in Washington for the alliance's 75th anniversary, after hours spent arguing over the exact wording of the commitment. And speaking of commitment, the most powerful leader in the room, Joe Biden, hasn't convinced his Democratic doubters to commit to him. And then came this, another speech, another gaffe.
I wouldn't have picked Vice President Trump to be vice president, but I think she was not qualified to be president. So let's start there. Number one, the fact is that the consideration is that I think I'm the most qualified person to run for president. I beat him once, and I will beat him again.
And it's been a week of protest against tourists in Barcelona. Anyone spotted rolling a suitcase or relaxing on the terraces of Las Ramblas sprayed with water pistols. Tourists go home, the message. This city is not for sale, they shouted, as millions head abroad for their summer holidays. We'll discuss how cities are dealing with over-tourism in our special one-off holiday segment, Wish You Weren't Here.
We should maintain sustainable tourism that allows people to live from tourism, but that does not prevent residents from living their normal lives in the neighborhoods.
Welcome to The World This Week, and joining me from the International Press Corps tonight, we've got Richard Worley, European correspondent for the Swiss newspaper Blick, author of The Ball of Illusion, how France, well, what France believes and how the world sees France. Great
Very
to have you
true.
On the programme.
Good evening.
We've also got Aysegul Cert, independent journalist, seasoned journalist, professor as well of the renowned University of Political Science, Sciences Po here in Paris. Good to see you.
Good evening.
Also, Catherine Norris-Trent, our senior reporter, in the midst of a must-watch documentary, just about to finish it, of her time with the gangs of Haiti and what comes next. It's great to see you.
Thank you.
And let's go to Brussels too, Maria Sara, EU correspondent for the Greek newspaper EFSIN. Hello, Maria.
Hello. Hello from Brussels.
Well, let's get to it. Monday, the morning after the election night before. The situation best summed up in the headlines of the newspaper Le Parisien. Et maintenant, on fait quoi? Now what do we do? Well, that looks like Richard Worley's book, The Ball of Illusions. It's a good plug at the right place. Well, it followed President
Macron.
And
the question is valid as well.
The question is always valid with your work. President Macron's shock announcement and snap election exactly a month before to, in his words, put trust in French voters to make the right decision after the far-right national rally were the national victors in EU parliamentary elections. The choice, not conclusive. Three political blocs now have a similar number of seats in Parliament. No one has an overall majority. And the newly elected Left Alliance coming out on top, Macron's centrists in second. The shock of the night, the far right in third. Despite what polls had suggested for days, beaten by an unfair system, tactics foul play, said 28-year-old leader of the Rassemblement National, Jordan Bardella.
Not questioning the democratic nature of the vote, but saying that without these arrangements, National Rally would have won the majority.
A letter to the French on Wednesday from President Macron to the regional press. No one's won, he said, urging mainstream forces to unite and adding that he wanted to empower the Republican front that countered the National Rally to be put into action. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Gabriel Attal's resignation request went in. Denied by the president, the show must go on for the sake of stability, possibly the Olympics too, until a new president, my prime minister, I should say, is found. So, where are we? Guide us through the political haze. Richard, you want to go first?
Yes, maybe with some updates, because there are news today which are interesting. The first news is that we got it from the France Info Radio that Macron will probably accept the resignation of Gabriel Attal by next week, next Tuesday, after the last Council of Ministers. That is an important news because it will leave the possibility for Attal to be the president of his group, the Macron group, at the National Assembly. So that means once you accept the resignation of the Prime Minister, the President probably looks for the possibility to form a government quite soon. I clearly don't see France being under a caretaker government for 2 months. So that's an important piece of news. The second piece of news is that Macron is apparently very angry at his own camp, which he has put them in trouble by dissolving the National Assembly, but he said that they don't behave properly. So he kind of warned them that they should do something in order to form a government. So you have a president who is not ready to step back. He is not ready to be kind of neutral referee only. He is still active in politics. He still has his hands on it. And I think that's part of the problem. Because when he said in his letter, nobody has won, he has lost. But he doesn't say it.
That's really interesting, especially given that he's been in Washington for a few days and he's still getting deeply involved. I just want to pick up on what you said there, though, because it is interesting. The idea of coming together, blaming your own party. Who's he talking about? I just wonder, is he talking about Gérald Darmanin, who seems to be critiquing Gabriel Attal as Prime Minister?
That's probably, I guess so. I mean, what he wants is people of his camp to continue to obey him, Emmanuel Macron. But why should they obey him while he is disliked by the French public to the point that they didn't use his image on the electoral posters? And secondly, he will not run for re-election in 3 years' time. So that is something, what puzzles me is that he still believes he is the boss while every indicator shows he's not the boss anymore.
I see. Good.
Well, I completely agree with what Richard Verli said, but also what is very interesting is the letter to the people that Emmanuel Macron wrote, and what you mentioned of, you know, when he mentioned that no one has won. Well, actually, French democracy has won, because there could have been a far right coming to the government, and it is not the case. So that's very hopeful. Secondly, I think it's going to be very interesting to see before the snap elections, we had a France that was very polarized, which, like many, many countries, but now it's even further polarized and divided, which means what you mentioned in your introduction of three parties that, because there's no majority, that they're going to have to do a triangular coexistence, which is interesting because with Emmanuel Macron, like Richard said, although he doesn't like to give up his power, he's also a man who doesn't like to compromise. When you have a government that is going to be a three-party government, you are going to have to give in and take a little. So that's interesting. And also, the problem that a lot of, I think, French people are having is this whole tone. And Emmanuel Macron, who came to power in 2017, has just been continuing to have, which is never taking responsibility for his own lack of experience, lack of humility, and really desire to be in touch with the people. To be in touch with the people when you're a president is not just like he does at the Touquet when he goes to vote, of shaking hands and kissing a couple cheeks. That's actually listening to the people. And what the French people have been saying from the very start of this 2017 Emmanuel Macron French phase is, we are not really voting for you. We are voting against the far right. And he has not been hearing them out.
We're voting against the far right. Catherine, you spent the night with the far right, Rassemblement National, on the evening of the election. How is the AREN, as they're called, how are they framing this?
It was really interesting because I was at what was supposed to be their election party, but it very quickly fizzled out, and some of the champagne went on drunk, actually, Gavin. And the people's faces fell when these results came through, because they were expecting to come out on top in terms of having the biggest number of seats in the parliament, and some of them saying to me that they really believed they could get an overall majority. And in fact, they came in third place, although they tried to frame it differently than that. They said, look, if you look at the popular vote as we've got now, they came out as the biggest party, so with more than 10 million French voters going for the Rassemblement National. So that's around like 32% of the vote. So they're still a considerable force. They increased their number of seats by a huge amount. They've got 143. They had 88, 89 before. So that's a big rise. Just think back to 2012. They were getting two seats in Parliament. They have really grown. And they're going to use this line of this coalition against the far right. They were already kind of framing that in a kind of victim-like way, saying basically the other political parties, the establishment is ganging up against us. You, the French people, aren't being listened to. So expect to hear a lot more of that.
Maria, when we listen to Catherine talking about, you know, the framing from the Rassemblement National, it's interesting that it wasn't coincidence that on Monday they suddenly set up and lead this new group in the European Parliament, a grouping across Europe, what they call the Patriots for Europe, with Hungary's Viktor Orbán involved in this populist movement too. Explain to us how that works and the power balance there.
Gavin, it's not my chance, of course. When we were asking Orbán's, MEPs or people here in Brussels, you know, they have also the Hungarian presidency in full alliance. So we were asking them and they were telling us, wait on Monday, because they wanted to see, they were hoping for a better result from the French elections. So yes, we have actually two new groups of far right, extreme right in the European Parliament. The one is the Patriots, which is the previous political group of the extreme right, the ID, Identity and Democracy, but with Orbán included. Viktor Orbán initiated this political group and invited all the political parties from the ID, the old political group, and now they have, they are the third power in the European Parliament with 84 seats. This makes them really powerful in the European Parliament, although there is a thought here in Brussels that there will be a cordon sanitaire, so that the MEPs from the Patriots, but also from the other extreme group, political group, the Europe also of Sovereign Nations, will be excluded from the seats of the vice presidents, questors, and presidents and vice presidents of the committees of the European president. And there's a big discussion on that now here, Gavin, about that, if it is wise to keep them out of any activity in the European Parliament, or if in this way, with this cordon sanitaire, this supports their narrative that they represent a lot of voters who are ignored by the democratic, let's say, political groups in the European Parliament. But I want to add something following your discussion. The feeling here after the European elections, and when I say here, I mean Brussels, was a relief. And oof was heard here as well, not only in Paris, but also in Brussels. Brussels is following very closely the elections, as you understand. And what a diplomat told me, which was very moving to me, and as a Greek, I really appreciate it, is that we all owe to the French voters a thank you, a merci, because for once more, they saved Europe. And this is really the mood here. This is how they describe the Sunday results.
Very interesting. And yet there'll be 10 million French people who are deeply angered, as Catherine said a moment ago. You're the share vote going to the Rassemblement National, and they have a point to say we've been beaten by the system. Richard, I just wonder your take on, when we listen to Maria talk about, actually there's a cordon sanitaire, we've heard that before, and it seemed to break around Europe, around the Front National, the National Rally. What do you think about their ability to be a disruptor within Europe, in that group?
At the moment, the National Rally and its allies in Europe are clearly not in position to block anything. So I would say that the capacity they have to prevent legislation to be adopted, or even to block commissioner when they will come to the European Parliament, because you know that's the procedure. You will have the vote on Ursula von der Leyen and then the vote on each commissioner. So I don't think the extreme right has enough votes to veto them. But let's see what will happen during the coming years. because it depends very much on how Ursula von der Leyen will govern, what allies she will choose. And you know how it works at the European Parliament. You need to make compromise. You need to have consensus.
Yeah.
So I would say at the moment they are on the margin, but they may find way to come back to the center, especially keep in mind that there will be elections, national election in countries. It's always like this in the European Union. In each country, you have an election per year. I mean, for the 27, you have at least one or two national elections per year. So let's see how it's going to move. Now, one very interesting thing to me, what Maria said, is that we see from Paris a handicapped Emmanuel Macron. In a way, he's now handicapped. He has difficulty. He has lost his bet at dissolving the national election. But Maria said it's not like this in Brussels. In Brussels, he is seen as the savior of Europe. So maybe it is his last card that he has. Though he's not the one who saved Europe. The French voters did. But they will associate Macron with the fact that he managed to be the wall against the extreme right.
It's interesting because just sitting where Aysegül is sitting now is Sandor Gozzi, a Renaissance new MEP in Brussels, and Paris Party saying, no, Macronism is not dead. Monsieur Macron saw the narrow path. The narrow path was the Republican arc. This was altruistic. This was not for him. This was for his party. That's the argument they put forward.
True.
And here we are now, Aysegül, in a position where people watching will want to know, away from the sort of everyday politics of government forming and how difficult that is, the names of who could appear as the next Prime Minister.
Oh, God. There are so many names going on. I would prefer to play Lotto tonight than to, you know, to put my name on it. I mean, to guess who
it
might
be. Let me give you one. Marine Tondelier, the Green leader. A lot of people talking about a possible solution. She's disliked.
She's been wonderful. She's been especially wonderful in terms of breaking down everything that Le Rassemblement National and Jordan Bardella was saying, that she knows her folders, she knows her subjects. There's also, of course, talks about a former French president, François Hollande, who might come back. There's also talks about Olivier Faure, who is a socialist. So there are so many names that I wouldn't go. The thing is that is interesting what Maria said is, one, Why was Brussels following what was going on in France so closely? Because France is a symbolic country. This is the country of human rights. You know, this is the country that says La République, La Laïcité. So it was very important for France not to fall into the hands of, yes, there's the Orbán's Hungary, but there's also Meloni's Italy, but there is also Austria. There's also, the Dutch who are going towards the path of the far right. So the fact that France said no, it's symbolically important. Secondly, it's not only Brussels, but Washington, D.C. in the U.S., they have also said thank you, France, because we have elections on November 5th. We are waiting for what might happen. So the fact that the far right, which has politics of populism, was able to be put on the side by the people, that's what in the U.S. a lot of people are looking at, saying, I hope that's what happens to the US when we'll be able to do the same to Trump.
Catherine and Richard, perhaps wise of Aysegül to say, it's too early. They're out the gates. Oh, yeah. I'm not getting involved. But at this stage, you're both seasoned Paris correspondents. Richard, too, are you going to summon a name for us tonight that we will say, I remember you were right on the 12th of July?
Catherine.
I think Marine Tondelier, the Green leader who we were just talking about there, who is saying she's been a very effective communicator. She's seen as, you know, more reasonable than some of the elements on the far left. But the Marine Le Pen of the far right has come out and said that her bloc would veto any ministers from France Unbowed of Jean-Luc Mélenchon or from the Greens. So she's clearly aiming against her there. So that diminishes her chances. Don't think it's going to be Jean-Luc Mélenchon. I mean, he's just too divisive. Some of the positions he's had in the past, you know, like pro-Chavez, anti-NATO, pro-Russia before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
Allegations of anti-Semitism.
Right, so he is, I mean, he's trying to stir up trouble at the moment, but I don't think he's going to be prime minister. I don't know. I mean, maybe Raphael Glucksmann, he could come back from Brussels. He seemed to get a lot of, he's a French socialist. He created this central, centre-left party, Place Publique.
He was a big player in forming the alliance, wasn't he?
Exactly, and he's popular, he's a good communicator, but I don't know whether he'd...
Seems to have ruled himself out. Or
right,
said,
if I was him, I wouldn't do that, but I don't know.
You have a look of a man who knows who it might be, Richard.
Well, Politically speaking, Emmanuel Macron would, if he wants to calm down the situation, he needs to find somebody from the moderate left. Because though the margin is narrow, the left has won the election. They arrived first. They don't have the majority, but they have the largest number of seats, the coalition of the left. It's very clear that he will not appoint anyone from the France Unbound. He has said so. So that leaves either the leader of the Socialist Party, Olivier Faure, and to me, he would be the more pragmatic choice for Macron, because he is the leader of a group, the Socialist group in Parliament, not yet formed, but being formed on the 18th of July, and that group will have a nearly equivalent number of seats with the France Unbound of Jean-Luc Mélenchon. We don't know even yet if the Socialists will not be a bit ahead of Mélenchon because of defectors coming from La France Insoumise to join them. So that makes sense to propose to the largest group of the left to form a government. So I would put a coin on Mr. Olivier Faure, though he has said himself that he doesn't want to dissociate himself from France Unbound.
He doesn't want to split the alliance just yet.
Renaissance say, well, that's the only way we're going to form a coalition.
If you look at the grammar of politics from Macron's point of view, I believe, but I don't know what Macron thinks, it would be better to have someone from that camp, moderate left, and then asking him or her first to nominate or to put forward some names for Minister of Foreign Affairs, Defense and Economy. Then
Build upwards.
That's what Macron should do or may do, but he may have another idea in mind.
Maria, you've seen the pendulum swing of different political parties in Greece. Are there lessons from Athens that we can take for France?
France is a classic friend of Athens. The Prime Minister Mitsotakis has excellent relationship with President Macron. He even copies him in some sectors, some decisions. Greece was hoping for the Macron's party to be one of the two first. And at the end, this came true. And they're very, very happy for that. But they are afraid, I mean, the government mainly, of possible left-wing government, although the opposition parties in Greece are very influenced of the result and now discuss of the possibility to unite against the conservative party that is ruling the country.
Well, that takes us to Wednesday in Washington, the family photo moment for 32 leaders of the NATO Defence Alliance. Best foot forward, straight backs, smiles as they walked on. 75 years since the original NATO treaty was signed in the same room by the then 12 founding members, committed by the principle of joint defence against the threat of the Soviet Union, now Russia. An attack on one nation considered an attack on all. Now with a new net member knocking at the door, Ukraine, a country fighting for its future, promised its membership was irreversible. It was now a matter of time, NATO said. More support too. Western-produced F-16 fighter jets on the way to Ukraine this summer, for flying missions, and a reminder of the urgent need of more air defence coming when the NATO summit opened on Tuesday. At the same time in Kyiv, the biggest children's hospital in the country, partially destroyed in a Russian missile strike. Meanwhile, the drumbeat of Democrats have dropped supports for the president, the most powerful leader in the room, to stand for re-election. And a curious intervention from George Clooney, the actor, a party donor, writing an op-ed saying he loves Joe, it's time to go, adding he's not the Joe of 2010 or even of 2020. The president has carried on the fight and has to carry on, and he will carry on, he said. And then this, another speech, another terrible gaffe.
And now I want to hand it over to the president of Ukraine, who has as much courage as he has determination. Ladies and gentlemen, President Putin. President Putin. You're going to beat President Putin. President Zelensky, I'm so focused on beating Putin, we got to worry about it.
Okay, Isogo, one of two moments that he didn't perform as hoped. Ouch. I guess for him, exactly the wrong thing to say, exactly the wrong time.
What is interesting is that since the debate between Trump and Biden, that was a couple of weeks ago, It was the first time that since 2020 that the two men had met. I woke up at 3 a.m. Paris time in order to watch it. I was ready at 4:30 when it was over to do a couple shots of tequila. It was so heart-wrenching. The thing is, the Democrats since then and everybody following the campaign is saying, please, please, Joe, don't make another mistake. And each time we keep just crossing our fingers, Joe makes a mistake. But the difference is that Joe Biden makes mistakes. Donald Trump full-heartedly lies. There's a difference. The thing is, it was very interesting. At the press conference that Joe Biden gave on his own, there was a great reporter, the White House correspondent from NPR, National Public Radio, who asked a fantastic question to Joe Biden and said, I've been following your campaign. You said that you will be the president of transition, which means you'll be in other words, you'll be the president for one term and then literally
you'll bridge to
the next generation of leaders. And then she said, what changed? And that was the question that everybody is asking. The thing is, he can leave. The ticket is Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, which means that this is America. If you want to do PR on politics, you can go full-fledged and make sure that Kamala Harris gets a high percentage. But there is something about this man who, unfortunately, for now, because I still have hope, doesn't want to give in. But I think he might, on this one, I would bet that he might step down. And in that case, the only possible option, since you asked me your name on the first round, I think will be Kamala Harris. Because there are options about maybe the governor of California, maybe even names going like Michelle Obama, who how many times that she have to say that she does not want to run for the president. And I think Kamala Harris is the only option that the Democrats have if they want to be able to wake up to a good day on the 6th of November.
Catherine, I suppose think Kamala Harris, the only option that they can have. Now, here's the difficult thing. So Nancy Pelosi spoke this week, one of the most powerful political figures in the world. She didn't say, she could have put this all to bed and said, I'm completely behind Joe Biden. She said, it has to be his decision. And yet he'd made his decision.
Right.
So it seems to be, are you sure you've decided?
Exactly. She's walking this very delicate line because clearly she didn't give him her full backing, which would have been very easy for her to do. And yet, so she left the question open. But he said he's already decided. We of course, understand from that she's saying in a coded way, Joe, it's not a good idea. Give it up now. Retire.
Choose the other option.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But for the Democrats, who they don't want to damage him so much that if he does end up staying on the ticket, they've all come out and absolutely laid into him saying he is not fit to be president. Because, of course, the Republicans will just use that as fodder for their election ads, for their election campaign. And he'll become so tainted. I mean, it's pretty bad right now. But he'd become so damaged by loads of Democrats coming out and laying into him or saying he's too old that, you know, they could end up having a candidate on the ballot who the party has basically trashed, so that they're in a very delicate line. And that's why more people haven't come forward, because they're worried about the damage they're causing to Joe Biden if indeed he doesn't desist.
Joe Biden's line hasn't changed, Richard. He is saying that, look at the polls. If the polls suggested a huge gap, then I'd disappear. But he's saying there isn't this huge gap. I can do it.
Zoe has opened a window, which is not a door yet, saying that if God's come to tell him to withdraw, he will do so. And when you know America, and when you know how religious Catholic Biden is, it means something. So it's obvious that he thinks of the possibility either to retire, to withdraw one way or another. Now, to me, there are two questions. First of all, the guy probably has not been convinced yet by his most trusted aides or persons around him that he is not able to do the job. And that comes to probably his wife, who at some point should tell him, Joe, it's over, it's done. And apparently she's not saying that to him, according to what I read.
Yeah, and we saw her reaction after the debate. She, applauded him and
exactly.
Welcomed him like a child.
So that is the missing piece at the moment. And the second missing piece is the money. He's got a lot of money, about $200 million, I believe. And before handing that sum of money to another candidate, he probably wants to be the one who chooses the candidate. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to be the delegates to choose someone. He wants to be the one who's going to call the shots and choose his Democrat successor as candidate. And that may be a problem. So I think he's stuck between these two things. First, he needs his wife to tell him, Joe, you go, before God tell him. And secondly, he needs to know who's going to get the money.
Maria, you wanted to come in.
I wanted just to say that coming from a small country like Greece, we all are wondering how come a big country like the US doesn't find another good candidate for a democratic for the Democrats. I mean, really, all in Greece, whoever I'm speaking with, they are expecting the convention in August. And they are expecting for Joe Biden to resign and give, as we say, the ring to the next candidate that will bring at least the U.S. closer to a better result.
Interesting that we also heard in the last few days Polish Foreign Minister Radoslaw Sikorski linking quite mythically the story of Marcus Aurelius to Biden, saying this on X, that it's important to manage one's ride into the sunset. At the moment, there's no sense that any Biden is riding off icicle.
No, but also what is very interesting, there's also the Turks and the Hungarians waiting very impatiently to see will Trump win, because a Trump winning, I mean, why are we following the US election so much? Because it is going to have deep, profound consequences on a lot of on the entire world. Countries like Turkey and Hungary are and Putin, so basically not the beacons of not the beacons of hope and democracy and liberty in the world, are following this because Trump is going to give them the green light. The thing is that not only Nancy Pelosi didn't really quite clearly say, Joe, I'm with you, but not really with you. Former President Obama as well. Remember, after the debate, President Obama tweeted saying, you know, there are days, there are some debates that are not good. That was not a good debate. Mm. The other thing is, look, I'm half the age of Joe Biden. Mm. I'm really in admiration of the schedule that this man has been following, of doing so many things in so many countries. And kudos to that. But the thing is, it is getting worse and worse. Mm-hmm. In politics, if you have no longer the trust of the people, whatever the polls say, it is of no importance. And to answer to Richard Verli, I will not even go into the wife and God Almighty story. We'll talk that after 8 p.m., my dear Richard. But I will definitely go into what will happen with the money. And that's why I keep pushing that the only possible option is Kamala Harris, because that money is actually the Democrats' Harris-Biden money.
I'm framing this in a week where we've had the NATO summit. I'm interested where leaders are gathering around him. Some are giving support. Keir Starmer, the new British Prime Minister, saying that he seemed to be on form. And a word, Richard, first with you, about the idea that they've stepped forward and they've said it is irreversible now, Ukraine's path to NATO membership. What's the ricochet effect of that?
I'm not sure there is a ricochet, because to me there's nothing new.
But Putin is promising reciprocal action in reprisal.
There's nothing much new for Ukraine. Sorry to say, but that was a bit a disappointing summit for Zelensky.
He got called the wrong name for a start.
Exactly. Can you imagine?
No, it's his worst nightmare.
Being in his place, being called Putin.
He cancelled a press conference after that.
Exactly. So it was not a good summit for him. There was this $40 billion amount that was put forward, but it's the total sum of money given by member country of NATO. So nothing new. And one thing that I wonder, but I'm just putting the question on the table. Orban, right before this summit, went to Russia, shook hands with Putin, then went to China and said during the NATO summit that he disapproved NATO confrontational stance towards China. What is Orban doing in this alliance? Who gave him the green light to do that? Is he some kind of outlaw? But then no one told him to get out of the room, or no one kind of warned him that he has crossed the line. So that triggers a little question.
And you forgot
maybe Orban was acting after informing his colleague. And maybe there is a second track that we don't want to see, where a number of NATO countries start to think, It's time to give up. It's time to talk with Putin. We call Orban a bad name. But maybe what he did, he had some sympathy from allies. Ah. I'm just wondering.
A silent approval. But don't
I'm
let
just wondering.
Public. Very interesting.
And just to add on, that's a great point, Richard Verli. He also went to Miami, to Mar-a-Lago, to shake hands and actually do the great sign with Donald Trump. And the thing is that are we talking so much about Orban? Because he has, for the current 6 months, the rotating presidency of the EU. So it's very important that this man is clearly a trouble for the European Union, is trouble for NATO, and he continues with the whole thing of kind of like the whole thing of what Netanyahu has been also going with. Hey, world, these are your moral values. These are the alliances, but we are creating a new world and a new system. And we're just going full force with it. And that's the scary part.
I want to make, Maria, tell us.
If I may, first of all, because Hungary is having the rotating presidency of the EU, some countries have already started to boycott the councils held by Hungary by sending public servants to the councils, not the ministers that are supposed to go to represent their country. So they show in this way the disagreement. Of course, there is a bunch of countries inside COREPER. COREPER is the meeting of the permanent representatives of the 27 member states here in Brussels. So this council has discussed the possibility of stopping the Hungarian presidency earlier. And they are trying to find ways. And one last, I was speaking with some analysts this week, at the beginning of the week, about the trips of Orban. And I was trying to understand why he does all this. Why he does all this. And one of them, David Hegemus, he was very, very, very clear. He said that Orban has a meta-communist mentality, and when he knows that he won't have any consequences, he will continue to do this. So something must be done by the EU. The EU has the instruments to stop him, but it needs to be political will to do that. And there, I totally agree with my colleagues speaking earlier about maybe some people are okay with Orban going to Putin and discussing maybe a ceasefire, because some of the countries are already tired of this war. Gavin.
Very interesting. It also reminded me of my Brussels days. Everything has an acronym. COREPER, the Council of Representatives and Ministers, you name it. There's an acronym for everything. Mm-hmm. You talked of optics as well. Let's just have a look, because what's going on here? Giorgia Meloni, caught on camera, eye-rolling with leaders. We call it undiplomatic diplomacy. Let's take a look at Giorgia Meloni.
That's so good.
Now, it has to be said, Isogel, that you know where the cameras are as leaders. This is not the first time we've seen this kind of behaviour. The last time it was with Emmanuel Macron. Can you be the mind reader in the room here? What do you think's going on? Does she know this is a display?
Well, she's there with the role. So you have to be there with the role, which means that you have to be there. You know, there are cameras all the time. And especially this, you know, this was a key date for the Washington summit. The only thing that I can say is that, you know, you were talking about you used the word disruptor in a way. She has been quite a disruptor for this summit this week, one. And two, the only good thing that has been going out from these images that we've seen is on social media. People have been so creative with, you know, there have been things where women analysts have said, this is how I feel when I'm in a conference surrounded by my man. This is how I feel when I have no more vacation after my first child. So at least there's some humor that came out of the faux pas, political faux pas of Meloni.
Bringing the humor back. Okay.
I'm loath to say I in any way associate or sympathise with Giorgia Meloni, but you kind of, you know, those EU summits are quite long, as you know, Gavin, and you know, we've all been in those meetings, so I'm like, don't want to express any support, but I kind of get the eye roll.
Enough said. Barcelona, Saturday afternoon, holidaymakers come in for a shock that relaxing in the cafes around Las Ramblas, a line of anti-tourism protesters, water pistols in hand, squirting everyone in sight, clearing the terrace tables, making clear their placard messages. Tourists go home. Barcelona is not for sale. Police saying around 3,000 demonstrators. Organised say it was five times that. It's a protest movement that's grown across Spain and the Balearic Islands. Almost 26 million people staying overnight in Barcelona in 2023, spending nearly 13 billion euros. But for those fighting for change, citing negative impact on locals, feeling priced out, increased rents, living costs, Airbnbs, they say taking over the erosion of a local culture. By Wednesday, the country's tourism minister said protesters were reprehensible, but that they didn't represent the nation, known for hospitality, and the extent, he said, was exaggerated.
I believe that we have to limit these expressions that I believe do not affect, but often are exaggerated in the international press. Therefore, I want to reaffirm the values of hospitality of Spain and the Spanish tourism model and one of its characteristics, which is security.
Tourism, according to the World Travel Council, is the third largest industry in the world, the fastest growing, 330 million people employed, 1.5 billion tourists travelling the world every single year. This year predicted to be the biggest so far. So it's a uniquely 21st century phenomenon, selfie culture too, people taking new pictures in the same places often, and this record summer expected. So to look at the issue of over-tourism, Richard, the world, is it ours to roam around and explore?
Are they ready to shoot a water pistol to themselves as well? Because who's getting the money from tourism? I mean, tourists go and pay. I do agree on over-tourism. I do agree on the fact that it's now very tiring to see people taking selfies always in museums, everywhere. That is true. That is true that social media habits have now become kind of burden on us when we travel. But the fact of the matter is that those making the most money out of tourism are the people from Barcelona, or I don't know if they are from Barcelona, but people who own the Airbnbs and so on. So you got a problem there because you can't blame the tourist without asking yourself the question, am I responsible?
I spoke to the organizer today of the protests who said, I mean, Daniel Pardo, he said, he was so fed up. He looked it. He just said, my whole environment, my quarter of Barcelona is gone and everything's so expensive. I just wonder if people are right to feel that their culture has eroded. Catherine, you've encountered lots of different tourist hotspots on your travels covering stories.
Not hotspots too.
Yeah. Darker places.
Visited places.
What's your take on the claim that people have, an erosion of culture?
Well, when it's just so concentrated on one place, and with things like Airbnb pricing people out of the housing market, that's something people are angry about. And if you go to Venice and you get these massive tour groups in, or those big cruise ships, I think they're banned now, it does spoil it. Or Dubrovnik, loads of European cities, you can't have the same experience that you could have before. So there's an argument against mass tourism. But we here in Paris see it as well. We live in a tourist city, and our economy also depends on tourism. So at some point, you've got to try and there's a balance to be struck somewhere. And there's many times when I'm walking through an area trying to get to work and there's a big busloads of tourists, you know, you'd be tempted perhaps to get a water pistol, but you've got to be welcoming as well. You can't just do that to people who are just sitting there having a coffee. I think it's really unfair.
A word from you, Maria, because just tell us about the situation in Greece, the impact of Instagrammable Greek holiday destination, and are there any solutions the Greeks have found?
Look, first of all, Gavin, I have to tell you that I was looking on the online for the increase of the pricing in the housing in Greece, and I found an index by Global Property Guide, which shows that Greece is in the second row with the increase from the last 6 months of 2023 to the first 6 months of 2024 per 10.7%. In Spain, according to this same index, the increase is 4.2%. So if Greeks would take water gun, they would try to send water to the government because the government hasn't done enough to protect the Greeks, that their basic salary, their wage is 700 euros. And now we have houses that cost 700 euros because of, for example, the digital nomads, people that are working from Greece for other countries. And you have these Airbnbs, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So you don't find, as Greeks, you don't, the Greeks do not find apartments to rent.
Yeah.
And some young people cannot even afford having their own rent, paying their own rent, so they go back to their parents to live with them in order to survive in a difficult situation in Greece. And
Now, Maria, I just want to bring in, because we have 20 seconds, I just want to bring in Icicle. Maria, you make an excellent point. Do you think, in brief, they've started this water pistol protest? Is this a tidal wave? Are we going to see more of this type of thing? Or is that one off?
I can tell you that I'll give you a cautionary tale story of Turkey, which was a country for which tourism was very important. In the past about 6-7 years, our economy has been impacted very badly because our political context was not very attractive, and so tourists were not coming, and they were actually going to my dear neighbor Maria's Greece, which is wonderful. What Richard Verli said, that if there is tourism is a place that brings on money, so you have to continue and find maybe new ways to control that.
Icicle Sirt, thank you so much. Catherine Norris-Trent, Richard Verli, and also
you,
Maria Sara. We are back after the summer. Enjoy your holidays. Watch where you go. Watch out for the water pistols. We'll be back for The World This Week in a few weeks' time.
Ukraine's Slovyansk has known war since 2014. A battle against Russia's occupation of the Donbas region has left its scars. 10 years later, will history repeat itself?
When they started shelling Slovyansk again, that's when I understood that the situation was serious.
Life has partly resumed, but Russia's war against Ukraine is omnipresent, and soldiers are mobilized on the front lines.
It's still a pleasant walk.
It's pleasant, of course, but more pleasant is when you're protected by solid concrete.
Locals are torn between hope and fear.
Can we change the situation? No, but life goes on. What can you do?
Slovyansk Revisited on France 24 and France24.com.